You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Wells King. He's the research director at American Compass, who's written two very timely and interesting opinion pieces that I think our listeners are going to find equally interesting. The first deals with globalization, that force that has dominated our lives over the past 30, 40 years and changed our country in many ways, not all for the good. And the second article deals with the decline and fall of NASCAR. It's getting a lot of attention online and from others who follow NASCAR. And you'll hear more about Wells' opinion about this sport and some broader implications. And yeah, there is a bit of relation to globalization here. So I think our listeners will enjoy this chat. Wells, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we'll start with the Newsweek piece on globalization, and you're pretty much ready to declare this almost dead. And in some ways, I think it's a good thing. But you emphasize this was a bipartisan mistake. Was there a tipping point here that that kind of turned the table on globalization that has arrayed the forces now questioning it, if not starting to reverse some of its power?
Well, I think there have been at least three events in recent years that I think have really forced a reckoning with globalization. The first was, I think, seeing the massive political backlash to the consequences of offshoring and deindustrialization, not just in the United States. I'm thinking sort of the themes that candidate Trump and Bernie Sanders struck on in their campaigns in 2015 and 16, but elsewhere in the world, the kind of backlash, the kind of heartbreak and anguish and social devastation that deindustrialization and the kind of cost of free and unfettered trade created. I think that was sort of the first, I think, moment where there was at least a clarion call to interrogate this issue in greater depth. And then I think more recently, the COVID-19 pandemic, which was in so many ways spread, was enabled by a globalized world, but the response was crippled by it, and that our supply chains were so weak because they were stretched around the globe and tied to hostile regimes that we saw, wait, hold on a second, this actually compromises our economic security. And the last, I think, is what's going on in the Ukraine with Russian aggression and particularly with energy supply chains, where we realize maybe being dependent on places on the other side of the world, much less hostile or potentially hostile regimes for our economic well-being and security, is not the right approach. And so I think these at least three events have, I think, really forced a bipartisan reckoning with what globalization did and what its consequences are, and I think trying to think through what could be in the future. But what I think is also really important, we have to understand that globalization was not just a sort of a one-time phenomenon a few decades ago. It wasn't just championed by a single party. This is a bipartisan effort, and it was built up over several decades. And I think trying to get to the roots of that and understanding the types of arguments made, the promises, the false promises that were made, is critical for, I think, trying to think about what a post-globalization future is going to be.
Our area, as you know, our neck of the woods here in the heartland, we're very familiar with number one, the deindustrialization. It just devastated a lot of communities in our region. And the promise was, well, you can move to where the jobs are, or you can go retrain. And I think both have had spotty responses at best. But it seems like what's really interesting to me, I think Americans woke up, like you said, and found out, you mean we don't make a lot of, like, masks. We don't make a lot of these things that aren't available. And also, for electric vehicles, a lot of the resources needed are not made here. They're made in the middle of where the war is.
Right. And semiconductors as well, which are in basically every electronic or computing device that we have, from you know, cars to laptops, smartphones, even some appliances. You know, we aren't on the bleeding edge of innovation there in a way we used to be, and so many of those semiconductor chips are made abroad. That's a critical supply chain, and it's driving up the cost of all sorts of things and hampering our ability to innovate and really be economic leaders in the future. Now, you're absolutely right that I think for many Americans, we had just had this assumption that we are the economic and geopolitical superpower, and we're invincible, and the economic strategy that we've adopted is one of strength, whereas I think it was exposed to ultimately be one of weakness, where we depended wrongly in critical supply chains, be it production of medical equipment, these sort of, you know, key inputs into technology, generic drugs and pharmaceuticals, that depending on a hostile China or in East Asia or a Russia for these types of goods was just a catastrophic error, and we really failed to see the risk because we were too wrapped up in a sense of American idealism that we were top dog and we could really do no wrong.
Yeah, it's placing, I think, theory over reality.
Absolutely.
You point out fairly, in fairness, in the Newsweek article that this, you know, had benefits. People said that it would help lift global incomes, lift people out of poverty, and it's done so. The other thing I really wonder, I mean, there's no question that it's been, in some cases, a race to the bottom on prices globally, where, yeah, we benefit from cheap goods. Do you think Americans are ready for that trade-off, where maybe we don't we spend a little more for items that to make sure that they're made in the United States?
I think it's going to be a challenge, but it's a necessary conversation to have. You're absolutely right that there have been real benefits to globalization. The one that I think we see and experience most directly are cheap consumer goods. Flat screen TVs are just so much cheaper now than they were years ago. And there's also, of course, been all of the benefits overseas. Billions have been lifted out of poverty by these policies because they have developed economically by virtue of us sending our capital there and creating demand for goods that they make overseas. These are good things, but they come with serious trade-offs. And you're right to highlight that we maybe need to reconsider these. In part, it's that these aren't the most relevant benefits. But in many ways, some of these benefits aren't as relevant as the cost. For instance, it's great that we're lifting millions out of poverty overseas, but this is trade policy and not charity, as harsh as that is to say. And we have to be thinking about our own interests and the benefits and stability of our own American workers, and putting them first and foremost, I think, especially in trade negotiations, and not thinking primarily about the well-being of workers overseas, as important as that is. So we can't jeopardize the well-being of workers here and the well-being of the stability and security of American jobs and production at home just for the sake of lifting others out of poverty. There are other ways to address that don't come with the same kinds of really hard costs here at home. And then on the consumption side, cheap goods are great, but there are other ways of getting cheap goods. You can invest in, you know, productivity-enhancing technology that makes creating better goods cheaper. That's a different route than just offshoring and taking advantage of the fact that labor is cheap elsewhere. So it really is less a question about ignoring the benefit and highlighting the cost, but rather, I think, looking at them fairly and squarely and trying to set priorities. And as far as I'm concerned, I think the priority should be ensuring that we have a resilient and stable American economy in terms of our supply chains, and that American workers are put to their best use in stable and secure jobs. Will that mean that goods are more expensive? Perhaps in the near term, although I think that American capitalism, when it's put to the test, has an incredible ability to come up with new technologies that lower costs. And do I think that this means we're that we will send millions into poverty around the globe. No, I don't. Because we can still have trade with those countries. It just needs to be fair and reciprocal trade. And there are also other ways to pursue economic development that don't absolutely impoverish and cripple the United States.
That's a great segue to my next question. I got to say this. I feel like if our listeners have done like I have, I've looked at this issue fairly on both sides. And look, I don't think this is saying it too strongly. We've been really cheated in these trade agreements. I mean, especially with China. Why haven't we enforced these agreements? Again, I think anybody would say if we engage in free and fair trade and we enforce these, you know, that's fine. But we really haven't. I mean, would you agree with that? We haven't done it. Why haven't we really enforced these agreements to make sure ensure fairness for American firms and workers?
Well, there are a lot of tools, existing tools at our disposal that we could use to especially enforce agreements with China. In terms of why we don't do it, I think there's a lot of potential explanations. I think the easiest, perhaps not the most fair, but I think the easiest explanation is self-interest of business and political elites, that doing business with China is good for them, that letting the Chinese off easy is good for them, even if it's not great for the American people writ large. I think in some cases, I think especially through the early to mid-2000s, just as China had entered the World Trade Organization and was truly a free trade partner with us, that we were distracted by wars in the Middle East and weren't able to have the same kind of laser focus on ensuring that China was a fair trade partner through that time. But in some ways, though, too, the policies we pursued and set up have actually crippled us and have kind of tied our hands behind our back. You can't reform the World Trade Organization, for instance, without the unanimous support and consent of all of its members. That includes China, by the way. So if we wanted to even change the structure and governing body of world trade to ensure that we were enforcing the rules and making bad actors like China play by them, we would have to get China on board. There's really nothing we can do there. So we've really tied our hands in the policies we've pursued while also being distracted and being led by self-interested elites.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to be joined by Wells King, who's the research director at American Compass. We're talking about a couple recent pieces he wrote. The first one is on globalization. It's called Globalization, America's Biggest Bipartisan Mistake. This article and the topic of globalization has enormous implications for our region, and it has. And I would encourage everyone to take a look at this piece. Secondly, we're going to be talking a bit about a piece Wells wrote in American Conservative magazine on NASCAR. But before we get to that, would you talk a little bit about American Compass? They've been a leader here in recent years in pointing out the flaws of globalization. It's really interesting. It's been a kind of a Nixon goes to China type situation where the folks involved are actually offering new ideas on not only globalization, issues like globalization, but also workers' rights.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that this is kind of a Nixon goes to China moment, and that we at American Compass do kind of fill a unique void. We like to think of ourselves as a flagship for, I think, a new movement that you're beginning to see crop up in and around policy circles, especially in Washington, D.C. You know, if you think the last several decades, the kind of economic policies that keep getting promoted and the kinds of ideas that get promoted in Washington, on both the left and the right, it's a lot of the same. On the right, they like to double down on a kind of free market fundamentalism, as we call it, the idea that the solution to every problem is either to introduce a market where there's not one or to free up the markets that are there. It really is a hammer that's in search of nails in every problem. And we love markets here. We think they're really powerful tools, but we also think they need rules and that there's a constructive role for government. And then on the left, I think in certain cases, you have seen a kind of a look to introduce more government involvement of the same kind of onerous kind again and again in a whole host of policy domains. And so what we're trying to do is actually offer something of a fresh perspective that I don't think has been pursued for some time, although I think it is sort of the kind of tradition of American policymaking to think in these more constructive and creative ways of saying, how can we ensure that our economy supports and emphasizes the well-being of American families, of American communities, and of American industry, and doing so in a way that really supports our liberty and our prosperity. I think for a long time, policymakers, policy wonks on both sides have really been thinking in terms of how can they unleash the market and let it rip, just grow the pie, we'll redistribute the gains to the losers, and we'll maximize consumer welfare. That is, we'll ensure that goods are cheap and plentiful. That's no recipe for human flourishing or human thriving. And so we at Compass are trying to think more holistically and more creatively outside of these kind of left-right conventional paradigms, but in terms of what actual policies are necessary to ensure that the economy we have supports the goods that are necessary for human thriving and flourishing. That is, good, stable families supported by good, stable jobs. Industry that is investing in itself, creating jobs, but also the kinds of innovations that spill over to the benefit of us all. And so this looks like things that are maybe kind of quirky to others, like we are conservatives, but we really believe there's a robust role for organized labor, for instance. We think that our financial system is run amok and doesn't emphasize the right things or direct investment to its proper end. There are a number of issues that we like to tackle across the board where we're just sort of demanding some fresh thinking, and there seems to be a real appetite for it.
Yes, and I have to add a further endorsement. I'm constantly on the lookout for fresh thinking. And if your listeners out there are tired of the old left-right, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative debates, try this out. I think you'll like it. It's a fresh approach, and just go in with an open mind and you'll see some really creative thinking by Wells and his colleagues, including Orrin Cass, who was on my show several years ago. So I really encourage folks to take a look. And with that, this piece on NASCAR is very interesting. I have to say up front, I'm not a big fan. I do follow it some, but I cannot say that I'm a big fan of NASCAR. But boy, I've got family members and friends that are. And I've run this article by them, and it's unanimous that you're spot on with this. But the article's called The Decline and Fall of NASCAR, and I want you to talk a little bit about it here, because I know we have a lot of fans out in our listening area.
Well, what happened in NASCAR is similar to the story of globalization that I just told, in that it's, at the end of the day, a story about perhaps well-meaning but ultimately self-interested elites that in the pursuit of profit and progress betrayed their ultimate constituency. It's a story about how NASCAR as an organization launched this deliberate campaign, really beginning late 90s, but taking off steam beginning in the early 2000s, to transform the sport, to make it more commercially appealing, more scientific and technologically managed, and less distinctively Southern. I begin my story with the death of Dale Earnhardt at the 2001 Daytona 500. There are a lot of moments where you can sort of begin this story because it's been going on for at least 25 years. But it's a story at the end of the day, I think, of a pretty familiar pattern of economic and political dispossession. The suits coming in and changing things in an effort to enrich themselves, and all well-meaning, all with, sort of claims to sort of grow and improve what it is they're managing. But in doing so, I think they leave behind, in this case, their core fan base behind, and they betray them, and they dispossess them.
What's interesting, you break this out on some of the reforms, and as I was going through this, the image has been changed. from some of the sponsorships and all. And it moved away from that key subgroup that decides elections now, the white working class, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about NASCAR, I mean, I can think of no other institution, cultural institution in American life that probably better represents, or at least represented, the white working class of the New South, you know, industrial, better than NASCAR. Its origins lay in the North Carolina Piedmont, where I'm from, on dirt tracks, later on asphalt ovals, with, you know, bootleggers trying to escape the revenue man, souped up stock cars that they worked on themselves, all of the early heroes of the sport, the carburetor cowboys, as they were called, hailed from the region. It has, of course, and a lot of this is true, these kinds of Talladega Nights stereotypes, right, that it's a sport for rednecks. A lot of those stereotypes contain a grain of truth. The really significant thing, though, is going into the 90s, it was really going national. NASCAR had just signed a massive TV contract at this point in time. It's unprecedented. It was right up there with the big four sports leagues in American sports, the NFL, the NHL, MLB, and the NBA. It was poised to overtake some of those leagues in terms of its ratings. It was a mass cultural phenomenon with the potential for mainstream appeal. And so NASCAR undertook a number of reforms, beginning in the 90s, but really, as I said, picking up steam in the 2000s, to change the sport in meaningful ways, not only its brand and its image and its appeal, but also the cars the drivers drove, the rules of competition, how they determined the championship, and even the venues and the tracks, the markets that they were trying to pursue. You mentioned the branding and imaging. I mean, one of the sort of clearest night and day examples is just to think about the old sponsors of the two premier series, the Busch Series and the Winston Cup, you know, beer and cigarettes. It later switched to the Nextel Cup and the Nationwide Series, cell phones and insurance from beer and cigarettes. That's sort of the simplest example, but of just the way that they wanted to change the image from sort of white working class consumer brand that maybe wouldn't have the same kind of mainstream appeal with the middle or upper middle class, much less in the lucrative West Coast market, and trying to make it appeal more broadly. But in doing so, really sort of sold its soul to a certain extent.
You gave the current demographics of the sport, which I thought were fascinating. Obviously they did this to try to broaden NASCAR's appeal. Is there any evidence that they had any success at that at all in all these changes they made?
They certainly expanded the reach of the races. They opened up tracks in Southern California, outside Chicago, in Miami, Las Vegas. They certainly expanded the reach of the sport. There's no evidence, at least that I've seen, that they really made at least significant or noteworthy inroads in terms of other meaningful demographics, be it sort of you know class or gender or age bracket. Even though in many ways the sport was again trying to sort of move beyond what it understood to be a bad brand and a dying demographic of working class whites in the South. Again, the fan base, though, is still that traditional core. It still is you know, 63% male, 80% white, and the median earnings are between $35,000 and $45,000. These still are white working class fans. It hasn't really truly changed the composition of the fans, at least not significantly. What it has done, though, is alienate a lot of fans. It's been leading rating for years. And even its flagship race, the Daytona 500, last year's Daytona 500 had the lowest ratings on record. So it's continuing to alienate its fan base, even as it fails to change the composition, which it wanted to change, including growing the fan base. So who knows what's in store for NASCAR? There are some green shoots that suggest that there may be some change, that, and that's encouraging. Ratings are up. They are trying to return to their roots somewhat. There's whispers and some efforts of trying to renovate some of the old historic tracks in the Carolina Piedmont. But they've really done considerable damage to a sport that, like I said, at the turn of the millennium, was a cultural icon and really about to be a juggernaut in the national sports scene.
We've got time for just one more question here. I want to kind of wrap up and ask you, got about a minute. Do you see, kind of bringing all these topics together, do you see any elected officials from either party, for listeners to keep an eye on, that may be, espousing the ideas that your organization has been talking about on globalization and other issues, the labor movement and all? Are there a couple people we can keep an eye on that seem to get this and are going to be leading on these issues?
That's a great question. You know, there are a number of, I think, really thoughtful current elected officials that are, I think, thinking creatively about these topics. I'm thinking especially about the role and future of organized labor, about the need to redirect investment. You know, a lot of these topics are sort of traditional, you know, progressive or union Democrat concerns. And so I think a lot of the sort of, a lot of the current elected officials that your listeners are probably familiar with and follow among the Democrats, they probably know those names and the ideas there. Who I think are consistently the most interesting are some Republicans that I think are bucking the conventional mold of free market fundamentalism, and are looking for ways and eager to think constructively and creatively in economic policy. I think of people like Senator Marco Rubio, who's put out some really interesting work, not only research, but bills on investment in the United States, on the need for industrial policy, on labor reform. I think of Senator Mitt Romney on family policy and the Family Security Act that he's pushed forward. I think of Senator Hawley from Missouri and the work that he's been done on trade and industrial policy and family policy. There are a number of really thoughtful and I think creative Republican lawmakers that are, I think, willing to do constructive and interesting work across the aisle. I'm hopeful for the near future that there could be some really interesting bipartisan collaborations between these Republicans and some of the progressive Democrats build up an economy that, again, wants to build a strong economic base for families, communities, and American industry to thrive.
That's Wells King, who's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the research director at American Compass. Again, American Compass. Urge listeners to check it out for some fresh thinking on some key issues. The articles, again, can be found. One is called Globalization, America's Biggest Bipartisan Mistake. It's in Newsweek. And then The Decline and Fall of NASCAR in American Conservative Magazine. Wells, thank you so much for taking the time to be my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed this. This was great.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.